from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, surviving the pain of a romance gone bad. We're joined by the author of The Little Book of Heartbreak. It describes how love, relationships, marriage, and breakups have changed over the centuries, and what science tells us about the physiology and psychology of suddenly finding yourself alone after an important relationship ends. We'll touch on monogamy, how different cultures approach love and marriage, and the best ways to get past a broken heart. And of course, we want to hear your stories as well. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, February, of course, is the month for Valentine's Day. It's kind of a hallmark holiday that raises all kinds of mixed feelings, especially if you're single. And this hour, we're joined by the author of what some say is the anti-Valentine's Day book. It's titled The Little Book of Heartbreak, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. It's full of anecdotes from history, invoking the likes of historic figures like composers Franz Liszt and Johannes Brahms, writer Ernest Hemingway, and the English singer Morrissey. Author Megan Laslocky. Say it for me.
Laslocky, yes.
Laslocky. It's a good Irish name.
Actually, it's a post-Ellis Island Hungarian.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad I asked. Anyway, good to have you with us. And tell me about this book. It is not a self-help book, we should say, at the beginning. It's, as I said, full of historical anecdotes and looking back at how different cultures have looked at love and marriage and relationships. Do you feel on the defensive at all when people say, oh, it's just another self-help book?
Definitely not, because I feel quite secure that it's not just another self-help book. I really wanted to write a book that was interesting to anybody interested in history and culture, but also for the lovelorn, was really an intelligent companion to the process. And I was inspired by a couple of books, such as Andrew Solomon's The Noonday Demon, The Atlas of Depression, which I found enormously helpful when I was going through some dark times. And precisely because it wasn't a self-help book, it was just a fascinating, well-written book. And so that's what I set out to do.
And you make clear in the book that you're happily married. You have a little boy, four-year-old boy.
Yes.
Why did you decide to write this book now? I mean, was it something that you needed to sort of have those difficult breakups far in the rearview mirror before you could write this?
Definitely. I don't think I could have written it when I was single and when it was sort of always a possibility. Once I was happily settled into family life and feeling secure and so on, then I felt like I could go rummaging around in the dirt of my own personal heartbreak, but also that of others.
Yeah. And did people, as your friends and others, knew you were writing this? What did you hear from them about, their own stories or what they wanted in a book like this?
Actually, as I was writing it, I think I was pretty private about it, and I didn't talk about the actual content that much. They knew I was writing a book, and they knew I was writing a book about heartbreak, but I think during the process, I needed to be a little bit private.
You, as I said in the introduction, there are a lot of famous people from history that you use, the relationships of people like Franz Liszt and Johannes Brahms, and some of them are fairly obscure. How did you go about finding these stories, and why did you settle on the ones you chose?
Well, some of them were stories that I knew already, like the story of Abelard and Heloise from the 12th century Paris was a story that I probably learned in high school studying French. But other than that, I just looked for the stories that really just spoke to me or had particularly interesting tragedies or backstories, I guess you'd say. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that culture, in one way or another, culture plays a role in almost every breakup. even though maybe we don't talk about it explicitly, but I think it's there. And so I became very fascinated with a historical backdrop of what was going on in each of these stories.
And as you point out, the whole notion of relationships has changed tremendously and continues to change, really.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of being something that was just very practical, that, you know, really love had very little to do with relationships, you know, until, I wouldn't say recently, but, you know, certainly not at the beginning.
Yeah. Really, a lot of people put the tipping point at the Enlightenment.
16th century.
Mm-hmm. 17th century
17th
and so
century.
On. Yeah. And so that's when it really started to shift with the notion of the self and that happiness was something that every person should aspire to and so on and so forth. And love was perceived as being part of that formula. So it really rose to prominence with the Romantics, of course. But at this point, I think that we're almost in a place where perhaps as a culture we're too focused on it.
And focused on
finding the perfect person,
the soulmate,
and true love, and that everybody deserves their true love and soulmate and so on. And I think that's wonderful, but I'm not sure it's really very practical.
Well, you look at India, for example, and a point that, you know, and in some parts of the world, India being an example that where I think you said something like 98% of the Hindu marriages are arranged marriages, and that the divorce rate is something like 1% compared mm-hmm. to 50% divorce rate here in the United States. And I think your conclusion was maybe it's worth looking at those trade-offs. And I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that.
Well, I think that here in the West, often we're quick to vilify arranged marriages. And when you look at the numbers, and when I look at some of the few arranged marriages that I've known personally, they've actually been very happy. And I think that when you have the idea of two families really looking out for the best interests of their children over the long haul, some really good things can come out of that. Not always by any stretch. Obviously, there are terrible marriages that come out of arranged marriages. But I think it's also because in my own marriage, I really have to say that I think that even though it was certainly not arranged, that it could have been. Our parents, our respective parents, get along famously. We have the same values, and it's really quite wonderful and very stable and loving. And so I think about that, and I think, well, if we lived in a different culture, our parents probably would have said this would be a great match.
Yeah. So in other words, if you have two families where they have the best interests at heart of these two people, that it could work. And it does work.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Well, you refer to a number of movies. The book is kind of broken up into history, culture, music.
Art. Literature.
And we pulled some cuts that aren't necessarily in the book, but from some movies. This is a little excerpt from Say Anything, starring John Cusack. He plays Lloyd, is it Dobler, I believe it's pronounced. And here's a scene from that movie where he's commiserating with his friends about his breakup.
All you gotta do is find a girl who looks just like her,
do that.
Nailer,
right.
And then dump her, man.
Dump her,
get
man.
Her off your
Lord
mind.
Knows we're right.
Your only mistake is that you didn't dump her first.
Word.
Diane Court is a show pony.
I
you need a stallion, my friend. Walk with us and you walk tall.
Walk tall, my man.
Dude, where'd she dump you, man?
My car.
Your car?
Man, dished in the Malibu.
Oh, heinous!
It's your castle, man.
Golly.
Man, you never had a chance with a girl like that.
Megan Laslocky, just one of many, many, many examples of movies, breakup movies. What's your own personal worst place, worst breakup story? Do you have one in terms of how someone broke up with you?
Actually, I have two. One I cover, it opens the book. I had been dating this guy very briefly, but I was so sure he was the one. And, you know, everything was just going so beautifully. And, you know, it was just terrific. And it felt fated and so on. And he came over for dinner one night. And he was about to move to California. We were living in Vermont at the time. And I was thinking of moving to California. And I thought that night we would discuss what we were going to do. And he came over with wine and chocolate. And then he sat down and said, we need to talk. And then he proceeded to dump me. And I was just devastated for months. And even though it had been a very short relationship. So that was pretty rough. And then many years later, I was in a long-term relationship with somebody for 3.5 years. And at the end of that relationship, he was living in a different city and he came to visit and we had a lovely weekend together and we were still working some things out and figuring out where things were. And he called me that Monday and I couldn't talk on the phone just then and I called him back and he simply never returned my calls. And that was it.
It seems like the way, I mean, that's those stories, they tell you a lot about the person, how they broke up with you and the fact that he didn't call you back. I mean, that says a lot about him, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I wasn't completely surprised because I was devastated but not surprised. I knew that that's how he had ended relationships in the past. And so it wasn't a huge shock. I just didn't think that he would do it to me.
Yeah. Is it your sense in putting this book together and looking at the history that the women tend to be the tragic figures more often than the men? That's my impression. But how do you feel about it?
Well, I think I was more attracted to those stories because obviously I'm a woman. But there are some incredible stories of heartbreak in there, of men, like the story of Brahms, who was just an incredibly complicated man and certainly had his fair share of heartbreak as well. So I think men and women go through it equally and just to digest it in very different ways sometimes and sometimes in exactly the same ways.
Well, let's open up the phone lines because I'm sure our listeners have stories, their own stories of heartbreak, love gone bad. And we'd love to hear from you. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Megan Laslocki. She's the author of The Little Book of Heartbreak, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. You know, in that clip, Megan, from Say Anything, these guys are looking for revenge, you know, for their buddy, their bro. You know, they want to have him find somebody to sort of break up in the same way that she broke up with him to help him get past it. What have you found, you know, works in terms of helping people move on, or what helped you? It's just, other than time, of course.
Well, for me, reading helped, and I'd be lying if I said that an occasional night of boozing didn't help. Let's see, what else? I think part of the reason why I wrote this book is that, as I said earlier, self-help just wasn't enormously helpful. And I found that the platitudes from friends, no matter how well-meaning they were, you know, oh, his loss, or there are other fish in the sea, or whatever.
We never liked him anyway.
Yeah, we never liked him anyway. Those just weren't very helpful. So I kind of needed to lick my wounds in private a bit.
Yeah, and writing this book presumably helped.
Yes.
As well. Music plays a big part in our culture, of course. Our friends at KQED Pop actually put together the Ultimate Heartache playlist, and you can find a link to that, as well as to 15 songs, a list for the brokenhearted on our website. It's kqed.org/forum. And you describe, or I think maybe you attribute someone else describing Joni Mitchell's Blue album as the quintessential breakup album. What is it about that particular song? That was after her breakup with Graham Nash, from Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Oh, it's just such a just relentlessly sad, beautiful album. And I started listening to it when I was, 10 or so, when my sister was listening to it. And of course, I had no concept of what it really meant then, but it still really haunted me. And then as I got older, I felt like I kind of grew into it and came to understand it much better.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that album in a long time, but I actually, as I was reading the book, remembered coming to California in, 1981, and playing that album in my car on the cassette deck. And just for, you know, at the time, I didn't know why, I just started crying. And, you know, I had left behind a love that I had broken up with or had broken up with me back in college. And, it really just, and there's something also about the sense of California being a place where people come to and they leave behind all kinds of things.
Exactly. There's that in it. And I think there's so much of the sense of escapism, the skating away on rivers and so on. That just infuses the entire album.
Absolutely. The book is called The Little Book of Heartbreak, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. Our guest, Megan Laslocky. And if you want to join us, 866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also leave your comments on the web. Send it to us, forum at kqed.org, or you can go to our Facebook page as well. Here's a comment from Christine, who shares with us, I recently saw Jackson Brown at the San Jose Civic Auditorium, where he sang In the Shape of a Heart with lyrics that seem apropos to this topic. And she writes, the lyrics here, people speak of love, don't know what they're thinking of. Wait around for the one who fits just like a glove. Speak in terms of belief and belonging. Try to fit some name to their longing. People speak of love. Yeah, lots of music. Do you have you have in the book sort of some suggested songs?
Well, actually, since the listener brought up Jackson Brown, just the other day I stumbled across "She's Got to Be Somebody's Baby," mm-hmm. which I hadn't heard in so long, and I just love it so much because it's sort of about the more abstract heartbreak that's not necessarily about a particular person, but the longing and the loneliness and so on. So I suddenly remembered that, and I was like, that's one of my favorite heartbreak songs. What are some of my others? Well, there's a Snow Patrol album that escapes my...
I should have posted it here in the book.
Yes, Escapes. I can't remember exactly the title of it, the album, but the whole thing is just a series of heartbreak songs. And one of them is You Could Be Happy. And that always just really struck me, you know, when you're completely separated from someone and they were an incredibly important part of your life and you have zero contact with them and they could be happy and you have no way of knowing. And that just always kind of kills me.
Yeah. Well, let's bring our listeners in. Let's go to San Francisco. Neil is on the line. Neil, welcome. Oh, I'm sorry. Karen in Sacramento. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Hi. It's funny. I just heard your radio show and I was like, wow, I need to talk to these people because I am just such a mess. No, I've just been through two horrific breakups. One was my husband of 23 years abandoned us suddenly. My son and I, and left for our best family friend, who we spent the last 10 years with sitting across the dinner table from. I called her my sister. My husband left me with the house, almost losing the house. I had no car. My car was broken down. All the bills were not paid. I mean, this is a man that you would never, ever, ever expect this from. I mean, he was home every night. We thought, my son and I just thought he was the most committed man. And I think that the financial part, he was self-employed, and you know, the times got hard, and he didn't have it in him, and I was carrying most of the load, but I couldn't carry all of it. And he had an offer. She supports him now. She's this friend of ours. He doesn't work anymore, and he lives with her. And it was like the pain was something I could never describe. It was like worse than getting stabbed in the stomach with knives, a million knives, and I could hardly function. I mean, I couldn't function. I had to, but I couldn't. And I got through all that, saved the house. I mean, I did amazing things. I mean, I'm so amazed at myself that I made it through all that and pulled it all together. But then I went and met another guy. And he right now is just, he is just killing me.
Killing you in what way? In a good way,
well,
I hope.
Killing me, like, well, first of all, I went for a guy who was fun. I figured I don't want to fall in love, you know, nothing, you know. He's younger, 10 years younger than me, you know. He's wild. He drives a motorcycle. He's fun, you know, and we have fun. But my goodness, he can go off and be done with me, just like that. I say one thing wrong.
Oh, wow.
Not just done with me, but this texting. I think texting is the worst thing for a relationship.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's not only texting, Megan, but I mean, we do live in a very, I don't know, it's so easy to meet people in a sense nowadays with online services like Match.com. But also, so I think all those choices sometimes make it harder to really choose someone because you feel like, well, maybe there's someone better if I just log on tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Oh, see, and I'm not that, you know what? I loved this guy. I mean, he maybe it has something to do with him helping me through what I was going through.
Yeah.
You know, he took, and I, so there's, a, I mean, I far more than I should, because I could do way better.
Yeah. Megan?
Well, you could do way better, but, you know, there also, it also might be the case that, well, let me ask you this. When did your husband leave?
Are you there?
Yeah. A year
okay.
and a half.
Okay. Okay. Well,
I don't see him or anything.
Okay, but it might be the case that, you know, you're okay by yourself for a little while, and you don't necessarily need to be in a relationship immediately. I mean, there are so many other ways to find love and satisfaction in the little daily moments of our lives, and that's not to say that certainly not that you should never have a relationship again. But there are so many other wonderful ways to do it. Like maybe you just, you know, can enjoy loving yourself for a while. Sounds like you need that.
It's like I want to let it go. And I don't know. I have that thing where the more you can't have it, the more you want it.
Yeah.
I think I have whatever that is with guys. And I'm doing that with him. And I want to let it go so badly. And I find myself starting to text him just because texting is so darn easy. And I don't want to do that anymore, you know, because he doesn't reply anymore.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care what I'm saying. And it's like, okay, I've got to get rid of my texting. Yeah.
Sometimes, Megan, it's almost like we don't know what's best for ourselves.
Yes, and there are things going on in your brain from a chemical standpoint, and I explain this in my book, that explain exactly why that is happening, why you were compelled to text him even though you know that it's possibly not a good thing.
You describe it almost as an addiction.
Yeah,
literally,
it is
a physiological
literally addiction. You are literally addicted, and you have to figure out how to kick it, just like any other addiction. And there are other things going on in various systems in your brain that explain why you're still, why rationally you understand that that madly texting isn't the great thing, the best thing to be doing, but yet you're still doing it.
And, so, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, anyway, I just have a whole part of my book that's on that might help explain that. And I think intellectualizing and understanding that sort of behavior can be enormously empowering.
And you point out also that the depth of the heartache isn't necessarily relative to the length of the relationship. I mean, that there are all kinds of other factors that are not really rational.
Exactly.
Which of course makes sense. You, one of the things I enjoyed in the book is that the whole phrase that so many cultures use heart, the heartache. You can find that in many, many languages. But in Indonesia, you point out, it's actually that feeling is tied to the liver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What accounted for that?
Well, it is connected to an ancient Indonesian divination ritual where they would read the innards of animals. So that's what it's connected to, and it translates as broken liver, heart, the concept of heartbreak. And it's really unusual in language because most languages, not all languages, but let's say many languages, use some combination of the term of the word heart and break. It could be heart and shatter, or something like that. But it's because most often it's centered there in our chests.
All right. Megan Laslocky is our guest. We're talking about her new book, The Little Book of Heartbreak. If you want to join us for the rest of the hour, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And we're going to go into the break with a little music from U2. Oh, we're not. Oh, sorry. In black and red, yellow, smoke clove, cigarettes, and drink vermouth. When I was 17, there would be a scream, but I don't want to get over you. As I walk this land of broken dreams, I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an what becomes of the broken heart. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. And as that song suggests, we're spending the hour talking a little bit about heartbreak. The Little Book of Heartbreak is the name of the book from Megan Laslocki, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. If you want to join us, the number 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phones right now. And Elizabeth is on the line in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi. I'm interested in both cultural and historical perspectives, and I'm in the somewhat unusual position of having high school classmates who have only had sex with one person, that's their spouse, and those are lifelong marriages. They're not easy. They're not easy, and I think that in a lifelong marriage, you really have to have self-love skills, but that's something that I've noticed in my mother, older people, and I find that it's an unusual perspective in the Bay Area right now, because it's like nobody has that perspective anymore.
Hmm. Megan?
Yeah, I think that that's really true, and that's something that I've wondered a lot about too. Certainly for our generation, and particularly in the Bay Area, people marry late, and they're not necessarily virgins when they get married. So I think that there's a lot to be understood about those relationships that where people pair off in as teenagers and it lasts their entire lives. It's really quite remarkable in this day and age when people live as long as they do. It was quite a different thing, of course, when people only lived typically into their 30s or 40s and married as teenagers. Well, you know, you weren't stuck with somebody for decade upon decade upon decade. So,
I don't advocate, you know, staying a virgin up until, you know, your mid to late 20s or 30s. It's just an observation that
yeah,
I've made.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely interesting, and it's shifting turf right under our feet.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thanks for the call. And different people are wired differently, too, in terms of what, I mean, there are folks for whom having, you know, being with a high school sweetheart is exactly what they wanted and are happy with, and others can't imagine that.
Exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and Mary in Castro Valley. Mary, welcome.
Hello. I called because I married my high school sweetheart and thought I had married Prince Charming, but he ran off with the other woman. So my reason for calling was to talk about how I got over it. It was very difficult initially. Thought I'd need to go to transcendental meditation and, you know, marriage counseling by myself, and crying a lot. And two people helped me, my sister and my father. And my father said I needed to set some goals so that I didn't just wallow in everything. And my goal was to travel and to not get married again before I was 30. That was my first goal. And then my second one was my sister said that I needed to focus on someone other than myself, because I spent a lot of time crying about it and doing a little bit of the, I wasn't texting in those days, but, you know, it's just thinking so much about him. And so what I did was I started volunteering. And I've been a person who's volunteered all my life. And the best thing is that those two things helped me to get over it. So I was 13 years single, raising a daughter when my husband left when she was 5 years old. And I felt that in that 13 years, instead of looking at it as a negative, I grew in my as a woman, especially since I had got married out of high school. I grew in my career. I raised the daughter, and then in 13 years, the Lord put me in a place where I accepted him in my life, and then I was prepared to meet my husband. And he's a Christian, I'm a Christian, and I think it makes all the difference.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call, Mary. It does seem, Megan, that there's a sort of a pull between, there's something healing, there can be something healing in wallowing in the loss, at least for a time. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, as the caller said, you have to move on at some point and really get outside yourself. You have to, you know, just sort of, I don't want to say move on, because in some ways those breakups become a permanent part of us.
Right. And the wallowing is actually quite important, many psychologists think, because what you're doing when you're ruminating and you're just chewing over and over and over again on what happened and on the person who you lost is that really you're sitting with the pain and you're learning whatever lesson it is that you needed to learn. And then, you know, as you move out of it, you can move on into other things. So, and I think doing something like volunteering is a fantastic way to help you get through a really difficult time.
866-733-6786 is the number. We've also got some email here, and one listener who wishes to remain anonymous writes, "My wife of 11 years went to Burning Man in 2007, and I never saw her again. She changed her name from Catherine to Sandwich, ran off to the Virgin Islands with a dude named Fuego." Have we fact-checked this? I don't know about this. "Where they live with their child named Buckaroo. She ended our relationship via an email that included the line, quote, 'The transformation that started nearly a year ago was accelerated by the environment on the playa. I feel like we're worlds apart now.' Yep, she ended an 11-year marriage by email, and I haven't seen her since." And then we have another anonymous email which says, "After knowing each other since the age of 12 years, knowing each other's families, etc., proposing on Valentine's Day with a 1-carat diamond center stone heart-shaped ring, marrying on the 15th of February the following year in a huge Valentine's Day-themed wedding, being married for 10 years, he served me with divorce papers on our wedding anniversary last year." Wow. Oof. That hurts. That hurts. Just reading that hurts. Valentine's Day is coming up, and it does bring up so many memories, good and bad, for people. And it sort of forces people, I think, especially if they're single, to kind of, you know, to look at their lives and whether they're happy being single or not.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
How do you spend Valentine's Day?
Wow. Well, because we have a 4-year-old child, we don't have any particular plans. So actually, it'll probably just be another night at home.
Night at home. Nothing
with macaroni
wrong.
And cheese.
Nothing wrong with that. Let's go back to the phones, and it looks like Scott in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for the topic. This is really interesting. I'm in a situation, or coming out of a situation, in which my long-term partner and I had a third person join us in a polyamorous relationship. And to make a long, dramatic story short, they ended up falling in love, and now I'm single.
Yeah. Aww. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, yeah, me too. But
did you think, oh, this can work?
No. Well, I did. I mean, going into it, I thought, well, it doesn't matter if it works or not, because, you know, my partner and I would go on and we would be fine. And, you know, that definitely did not turn out to be the case. So, you know, it's a gay male couple, it's not unusual in our community to have open relationships or polyamorous relationships. But what we found was that we just made a lot of mistakes and we didn't really have the tools. There was nothing to guide us in that kind of relationship. A book like The Ethical Slut turned out to be really limited. There was no real form or function by which we could structure that experience.
Yeah. And Megan, you talk in the book about monogamy, and there's a reference to Dan Savage, who was referred to a lot in a New York Times magazine cover story, mm-hmm. about a year ago, and mm-hmm. what he called with his partner monogamish, mm-hmm. which is monogamy with some rules, some ability to play outside the relationship. What do you think of, what are the pros and cons of those kinds of things?
Well, you know, I think it's important to remember that people's brains are wired among individuals. Their brains can vary tremendously in terms of how well they are wired for monogamy. So some people have both the chemicals and the receptors to be very, very good at monogamy, and others don't. And it's really brain structure and, again, chemistry. And so I think that makes it very tricky, and that we live in a society that celebrates monogamy so much, and it's so important to find the one and the, you know, Mr. Right and the person for the rest of your life. But at the same time, we live so very long that it's really an enormous challenge, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, certainly today, different cultures view monogamy in different ways. I mean, the French are sort of famous for, you know, looking at that other relationship on the side as something sort of normal outside of marriage. What did you find in doing research for the book about how the view of monogamy changed through history?
Well, certainly it changed, you know, in the early 20th century and so on, moving onwards, and certainly with the rise of feminism. But, you know, previously it was in in British and American culture, I mean, I wouldn't say assumed that particularly a husband would have something on the side, but it was certainly not such a big deal. It certainly wasn't a deal breaker the way it often is for us now.
Yeah. And what changed then in the 20s? Did you say the rise of feminism?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of a double-edged sword, you know, that women became more empowered about what they wanted.
They didn't have to be married.
They didn't have to be married, and they could walk away if they felt like they weren't being treated the way that they wanted to be treated.
Yeah. Well, Scott, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing that story. 866-733-6786 is the number. Let's go now to Oakland. And Deborah, welcome.
Hi. This is a great topic. Really enjoying it. And want to buy your book, Megan.
Oh, great.
This goes back to earlier. I just wanted to contribute what I think is the ultimate perfect breakup song that's very new is Gautier's Now You're Just Somebody I Used to Know. I don't know if that's the whole title. But kind of sums it up, because someone that is just, as you were saying, such an important part of your life, and then they're gone, and they just become somebody you used to know.
Yeah. What I like about that song is that you hear the two sides of the story and how two people can look at the same set of circumstances and see very different things.
It's such a brilliant song that the cynic and the snob in me is surprised it's become so amazingly popular.
Yeah. Well, they were on Saturday Night Live. I think that maybe put them over the top.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for sharing that. We've got some email here. Somebody writes, can Megan talk about unrequited love? My biggest heartbreak wasn't a breakup because we were never actually paired, but very painful just the same. I experienced about 6 months of insomnia, many nights crying, the painful realization that the man I love simply didn't see me the same way. And then one day, poof, I realized I was over him. I don't know if I've ever felt so liberated.
Wow, what a great poof. That's fantastic.
Yeah. If only, right?
If only. Yeah, I think that is... that's actually something that's not talked about so much. And I think that we define love so much as being about two people, but the one way unrequited love is can be absolutely excruciating when it doesn't go right.
Do you think that's something that younger people are more – I mean, how does age, do you think, change the way we look at those – you know, kinds of relationships or non-relationships?
I think that as you get older, at least this has been my experience, you just kind of naturally weed out, because you have more experience, you weed out the people who aren't attracted to you, and you just kind of don't let yourself go down that road.
Yeah, they're not available. You don't pursue it. Here's another email from Jessica, who writes, the saddest heartbreak song ever has got to be Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me If You Don't. Yeah. I'm happily married now, but I still can't listen to that song because it hurts so much. Yeah.
Oh, that one is a doozy.
Yeah, it is a doozy. I remember that one as well. Let's listen to another movie clip if we can. Danny, do we have one queued up? This is from Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and this is the breakup scene in that movie where Jason Segel is awkwardly naked during the entire scene.
Peter, as you know, I love you.
Are you breaking up with me?
We're leading different lives. It's like you're standing on the dock and I'm in the lake.
Sarah, I swear to God, I'll jump in the lake like a merman.
Do you want to put some clothes on?
Would you like to pick out the outfit that you break up with me in?
Jason Segel from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I did not see that movie, Megan, but... funny.
It is. Yeah. And great cast and very, very funny and timely, yes.
Yeah. Is there what are your favorite breakup movies? Do you have any?
Well, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, I think, is just a simply amazing movie. I love that one. That's the one starring Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet, in which they have their memories of each other erased, and it's just beautiful filmmaking, but also just
great concept,
fantastic one. And then there's The Painted Veil, which is based on the Somerset Maugham book, his novel, and that stars Naomi Watts and Liev Schreiber and Ed Norton. And I think that really shows kind of the various stages of heartbreak in a really, really wonderful way.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. And we got up to Point Reyes, and Allison is on the line. Welcome.
Hi. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm kind of up in the mountains. So
that's all right.
Not as good.
Oh, you sound
Thanks
good.
Thanks so much for having this topic. So I guess I'm so glad that I was able to get through. When the author was talking about, you know, success in marriage and people being together for, you know, their whole lives, you know, I just like to question what is success, because, you know, my example is I was married. I had a first marriage. My parents approved tremendously. I wasn't incredibly satisfied or happy. And after a series of other breakups of that marriage and a series of other relationships, I finally did find the person who is the love of my life, and we have two wonderful children. But on paper, would that be a success story if you say, oh, well, there's been a breakup and they weren't married their whole lives, and there was a divorce? Of course it's a success story. But I guess my point is, you know, each relationship has helped me evolve, and I think helps everyone evolve into what they want and what they don't want, and can lead them to, you know, an ideal relationship eventually.
Yeah, because we do learn, Megan, from our mistakes, or not mistakes, but heartbreak.
And I even find myself faintly nostalgic for the times when I was just such a wreck with heartbreak, and kind of proud of myself for feeling just that horrible and getting through it. You know, I think it can be pretty cool in a way.
All right, Allison, thanks very much. And even if you have heartbreak, being up in Point Reyes has to help. It's one of my favorite parts of California. Thanks for calling in. Here's some more email now. Charlie writes, as an SF divorce mediator for several years and educator around California marital rules, what does the author think of marriages which, absent having children, would last for 10 years? At that point, the partners could decide to re-up for another 10 years or not. And the most important thing, not view relationships which don't last forever as failures.
I think that that's a really good point. I think that the one-size-fits-all model for marriage is problematic. And I've heard of these marriages before where they basically renew a contract every year, every 5 years, every 10 years. And I think for the people for whom that works, it's a great idea.
Yeah. It seems a little unromantic.
It is a little unromantic. I will give you that.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. A lot of people want to weigh in on this. Joe in Santa Clara, welcome.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was just commenting on some of the music that you were talking about that helps people through breakups. I remember going through a pretty bad breakup. I was a lot younger at the time, but, you know, the emotions were pretty high, and I listened to an album by Bob Dylan called Blood on the Tracks, and it was I felt it was an album that could, the whole album is like a musical journey through every emotion that you feel when you go through a bad breakup like that, from extremely angry, vitriolic songs to songs about reminiscing about how you met to beautiful, beautiful love songs like You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go. And it's an album just on a point that you made just briefly, the author made just briefly about being nostalgic about going through those breakups. It's an album that I constantly listen to at least once a week. And it does brings back all those, you know, those memories of the roller coaster ride that you go through when you do go through a bad breakup like that. But it's probably one of my favorite albums of all time now.
Yeah. When did that come out? That was like the mid-70s?
Yeah, something like that. I believe it was a breakup with his wife, and he wrote the album all about it, and it's obviously he was going through the same issues.
Yeah.
So he's a fantastic album.
Yeah, well, Joe, thanks for sharing that with us. And, you know, I guess those things are easier to listen to with a little time in the rearview mirror, though, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's another email from Eric in Guerneville, who writes, I found that for me, the artist who best helps in times of heartbreak or heartache is Joan Armatrading, especially her album Down to Zero. Her lyrics, deep contralto voice, and vocal dynamics have helped me through many a breakup, as well as many deaths of friends and loves from AIDS back in the 80s and 90s. And Candace writes, there's also something to be said about the break in your life that a breakup can deliver, which forces one to reassess their lives, just like any large life change. Maybe breakups can also be positive times to reflect, regroup, and move on. And Leonor writes, wondering what was the most surprising or unexpected thing that she discovered about heartbreak while writing the book?
One thing that I found really fascinating was that psychologists call heartbreak, it falls within the category of social pain, or the pain of social rejection. And I found it fascinating to learn that fMRI scans show that the pain, physical pain of a burn, and social pain follow exactly the same pathways in the brain. So there was one study in particular that in which they thought, okay, so if they follow the same pathways, then can heartbreak or social pain be medicated? And so they gave a group of people who were suffering through rejection or social pain Tylenol. And it did, in fact, have an influence. And I found that just fascinating.
I wonder if it was partly a placebo effect.
Possibly.
Yeah. I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Although there's something to be said, you know, about, although it is obviously painful, there's something to be learned from that as well. Mm-hmm. If you can just medicate your way out of things, then you don't really learn so much from it.
Exactly. And that's the slippery slope.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're listening to Forum, and we're talking to Megan Laslocky about her book, The Little Book of Heartbreak, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And let's go back to the phones. Bill in Sacramento, welcome to the program.
Hello. Years ago, I was stationed on a large military installation here in California. And my wife worked on a far distant part of the same base. And one day, we weren't getting along, and we're talking and becoming pretty indifferent to each other. And one day, I was on a third section of the base waiting for a meeting, and I was just standing there looking out the window. And I saw a couple walking down the street about half a block away, walking in the other direction. And just the way they were holding hands and focusing on each other as they talked to each other, they just seemed so happy. And I just remember thinking, man, that's what I want to have back in my marriage, and just how lucky that particular couple was. It was right after I had that thought that they turned sideways, and it was my wife.
Mm. Oh. Wow, that's horrible. How long ago was that, Bill?
Oh, it's been a couple decades. We broke up after that, or we were probably on a route to breaking up before that. But one thought that, or one explanation that I came up with, because a lot of people always thought we were the perfect couple and couldn't understand how we broke up. And the best way I came to be able to explain it to people was, just because a dog and a cat don't get along, it doesn't mean the cat's a bad cat or the dog's a bad dog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. And Megan, it also points out that you really can't tell what's happening in a relationship from the outside.
Absolutely.
You know, it's easy to judge. I mean, you hear so many stories about couples that break up, and you know, their friends will say, "Wow, they seem so happy."
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you really can. It's hard to judge both, you know, what's happening, but also why things happen, and mm-hmm. and who was right and who was wrong. Let's try to sneak in another call if we can. Here, Michael in Oakland is on the line. Michael, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I dated my best friend of 10 years briefly about a year and a half ago. I just started having feelings, and at some point I told her, and she kind of, you know, waffled and said yes, and then she said no and came and went. And eventually we had, like, a relationship for a pretty brief time. And I guess, you know, my question, or the thing I wanted to bring up, is that when you know somebody that long, the hardest part for me in the grieving process has been to be angry. Because, you know, you care for that person a lot, and you have a lot of, you know, just built up things that you've gone through over the years that make you have a lot of, good common feelings, compassion, and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. So it's been really hard for me to, you know, kind of be upset with the wrongs that happened.
Mm.
I don't know what part of the grieving process that is. But
yeah, it seems like anger is an important part of it.
Yes, definitely. And very natural.
Yeah, and maybe you can figure out a way, Michael, to get in touch with that. Megan, we're getting close to the end of the hour, but I want to ask you, there were so many historical anecdotes and stories of love and love gone awry in the book. Which ones really spoke to you most, or did they all, and that's why you chose them?
Well, one story that I really particularly love is the love story between the composer Franz Liszt and his mistress, Marie Daigou. She was a married aristocrat when they met, and she left her husband and child to be with him. And really, she managed to bag one of the hottest men in history. He was enormously talented, very attractive, very charming. Personable, charming, and a reader. So she had really done quite well, and they really flagrantly upset expectations about how people were supposed to behave with respect to rank. And but that story, I think, is really interesting as well, because there's kind of a double heartbreak in it, because when they split up 12 years later, they had three children together. And then it was the protocol that if a couple split up, the man kept the children. And she didn't see their children again until they were adults. So that's the kind of story that I was really struck by.
Yeah. Well, again, the book is called The Little Book of Heartbreak, Love Gone Wrong Through the Ages. Megan Laslocky, thanks so much for coming in, sharing some of those anecdotes. And by the way, just to remind you, the music that we alluded to earlier, you can find was put together by our friends at KQED Pop, and sort of the ultimate heartbreak playlist. You can find a link to it as well as to 15 songs at our website, kqed.org/forum. Megan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Forum is, oh, by the way, we're going to go out with a little bit of more heartbreak music, a classic by Etta James. And let me just say, the Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Reveal the tears that was on
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.